In 1979, when they made Star Trek the Motion Picture, it was what we call a runaway production, which is to say that for whatever reason or reasons, money was just being poured at this thing. It was actually $45 million, and $45 million may not seem like an awful lot for a Hollywood movie today, but in 1979, it was simply unheard of. And the script was in such, I guess, dubious shape that the changes, the page changes that you get with scripts were not dated by the day. They were dated by the hour, as in, did you get the 4:30 changes yet, and so forth.
Right.
So it was obviously very, very confused. When I came on to Star Trek II and, you know, found myself meeting and dealing with Gene Roddenberry, he had a sort of ex officio relation to the movie. He gave a lot of notes, which, interestingly enough, I'd completely forgotten until I was back looking at a collection of my papers at the University of Iowa, and I saw all these memos flying back and forth between us that I'd completely blocked. We were always somewhat at loggerheads, Mr. Roddenberry and myself. I think he had his own sort of utopian vision of the future and of the perfectibility of man, and I always was sort of curious as to where the evidence for that was based on the story so far. So I think, you know, Star Trek is like a bottle that was created by Gene Roddenberry, and ever since, different writers, different directors, different actors, different composers sort of pour their own vintage into the general shape of that bottle. So, you know, you're given Kirk, you're given Spock, you're given McCoy, you're given these characters, you're given something of the world that they inhabit, and then it's inevitable that who's ever making the movie or the television series confers their own stamp, their own point of view, their own aesthetic sensibility onto that incarnation of Trek. And the ones I worked on, 2, 4, and 6, well, yes, I decided this is the Navy. You can call it anything you want, but this is the Navy. And, I mean, Roddenberry said, no, it's not the Navy. It's not a militaristic organization. It's the Coast Guard. And I said, I think we're splitting hairs here.
No, I don't think you are. I mean, I think that is the essential difference between those two visions, is the Coast Guard, while very cool, and I love the Coast Guard Academy, and I love the Coast Guard, I think it's a neat organization, it's not as sexy as the Navy. You know,
well, I don't know, but I mean, there may be something to that, but it's also true that when I watched all these Star Trek episodes, I thought, well, am I not witnessing a kind of gunboat diplomacy, where at the end of the day, although they are ostensibly on sort of a peaceful mission, they do get into all sorts of scrapes and difficulties.
Yeah.
And there is a sort of an assumption that, you know, the Federation's way is the best way, it's the civilized way, and by the way, it's always a sort of a white man who's driving the boat. There may be a sort of an interracial supporting cast, but we know who's in charge.
But to go with that difference between the first Star Trek and the second Star Trek, I think it's the difference between the gatekeepers and the gate crashers.
Maybe.
And the gate crashers are a lot more interesting to watch. I mean, God bless the gatekeepers, but in terms of it being, you know, some sort of dramatic motif, it's a lot more fun to see people thrashing about and you know, taking on these bigger causes than it is people trying to keep the peace, which we need, but it doesn't necessarily make for great drama.
Well, I think, I mean, that's another thing that, you know, Roddenberry said on more than one occasion. He enunciated this idea that it would be a world without conflict. And, you know, if there ever were such a world, I think we'd all probably be extremely pleased. We might be a little bored, but we would probably overall be pleased. It's just that from a dramatist's point of view, drama is is conflict and vice versa. And without it, Hamlet would be an extremely dull play.